Welcome back to another episode of City Hall Pass. I'm Kapel Lungani, counsel to the mayor of New York City. We created this forum, the first of its kind in New York City, to give you, the public, a unique window into the highest levels of our city government. We interview New York City's finest public servants and get them to open up in a way that is both deeply personal and insightful. And on its best days, we hope that our podcast is equal parts educational and inspiring. And now I want to introduce my two co-hosts today, two brilliant women who inspire me every day, Bess Chu and Kate Coughlin.
Thanks, Kapel. Happy to be here. This is Bess Chu. I'm currently Chief of Staff to the Office of the Counsel to the Mayor.
Hi, I'm Kate Coughlin, and I currently serve as Deputy Counsel for the Office of the Counsel to the Mayor.
Our guests today are Errol Lewis and Sally Goldenberg, New York City media icons who cover many of the city's biggest stories. Errol Lewis is the political anchor of Spectrum News' New York One, where he hosts the iconic Inside City Hall, a nightly primetime show that focuses on New York City politics. He regularly interviews top political and cultural leaders and has moderated more than two dozen debates, including the race for mayor, public advocate, city and state comptroller, state attorney general, and even the U.S. Senate. He was also a panelist in a 2016 Democratic presidential debate in Brooklyn between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. Errol is also an adjunct professor of urban reporting at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism. Prior to joining Spectrum News' New York One, Errol served on the New York Daily News' editorial board, and he still pens a weekly column for that same newspaper. He also hosted a weekday talk show on AM 1600 WWRL. Our second guest is Sally Goldenberg, a City Hall Bureau Chief for Politico New York. She joined Politico in October 2013 to cover New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio's administration with a focus on budget and labor contracts. Sally also spent 3 years covering the city's housing and economic development agenda. Previously, Sally covered the New York City Council and former Mayor Michael Bloomberg's administration for the New York Post. She also reported for the Staten Island Advance and covered municipal government for the New Jersey Star Ledger and the Hillsborough Beacon. In this episode, Errol and Sally spoke about their unique approaches to covering City Hall, their takes on the state of journalism today and the influence of social media, and how their work has been impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic. We hope you enjoy. My next guests really need no introduction. They're both New York institutions in their own right. I want to welcome Errol Lewis of New York One and Sally Goldenberg of Politico to City Hall Pass. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Great to be with you.
Likewise. Thanks for having me.
Normally, as our listeners know, we interview policymakers and public servants to discuss their backgrounds. However, on this episode, I thought it would be interesting to interview the people who actually cover these policymakers to give our listeners a unique insight into what I consider to be the best press corps in the country. Errol, I was pleased to learn, and I found it fascinating, that you have a law degree. You not only ran for city council, and you actually co-founded a community credit union. What drew you to journalism?
Journalism, by the way, is the main gig. Everything you just described were these temporary deviations, many of which were not quite successful. I got into journalism really as a teenager when I was in college. I had read papers all throughout growing up. And honestly, if I had to really blame anybody, it would be a combination of my late mother, who just inundated me with lots and lots of magazines. And the other was a program that I don't think exists anymore, where the New York Times would send people to elementary schools. You would get a subscription and they would show you how to read the newspaper. What was the lead? What was the front page? What was the op-ed page? On and on and on. And it was absolutely fascinating. And I was pretty much hooked. This happened around the Watergate era. We were told to write down the name of every person involved in the Watergate story. I'm in fifth grade now, sixth grade maybe. You write down the name of everybody who's involved and why they're involved. They basically turned me into a journalist right then. So to a certain extent, I feel like I had no say in the matter. And it turned out I really liked it.
Sally, I want to talk to you a little bit about your experience covering City Hall. Why did you want to cover City Hall? And did you look at the City Hall beat as sort of the pinnacle of what any reporter in New York City would want to do, in the same way that the Washington Press Corps looks at covering the White House as sort of being the pinnacle?
Yeah, that's a good question. I started actually on the City Hall beat when I was at the Staten Island Advance in 2007. I had been at the paper for a few years covering kind of general assignment. It's, you know, a local paper, so we covered a lot of crime that happened on Staten Island and incidents. And so I was sort of a general assignment reporter covering local news. And the City Hall spot opened up. The longtime reporter was retiring, and there was quite a bit of competition, if I remember correctly. You know, a number of people thought it would be pretty cool, like, to get off Staten Island and go into Manhattan every day and get to question the mayor and sit through council hearings, which at the time I really did think seemed very cool. I maybe don't feel quite the same way now, but it just seemed, it seemed important. It's where important decisions were made that affected people's lives. It seemed big and important, and I was really excited at the prospect of it. So that was my kind of introduction to City Hall. And then I worked at the New York Post in City Hall for 5 or 6 years, covering primarily the city council. I covered the 2013 election, and that was a very crazy and interesting election. This one might rival it, honestly. This is a weirder mayoral race, but that was very exciting. And I don't know if I thought of it as the pinnacle, because I do think coverage that's long form, coverage of issues, Nikita Stewart at the New York Times, as an example, delved into the social service network and homelessness better than almost anyone I can think of in recent memory, and did such important work. So, you know, there's other ways to tell people what's happening, to illustrate problems, to hold power to account. But I did always really want this experience. And I mean, I've been doing it for a long time. So obviously, I guess there's something about it that I'm sort of addicted to.
You know, one of the things that I've seen in watching you on TV, Errol, and reading your work, Sally, is both of you have a passion for politics. And in many ways, I think you are students of politics. How important is it to your job to have an understanding of politics and a real passion for it?
Very. I sort of think of my job as in two parts. During campaign season in particular, it's covering politics. And that is understanding politicians. It's understanding what makes them tick. It's understanding voters. I spend a ton of time pouring through Board of Elections results from past elections to see what neighborhoods really vote, what neighborhoods don't vote. I try to go out to these neighborhoods and talk to people, talk to ministers or rabbis, talk to community boards. That stuff doesn't always make it into print. Understanding the picture of what gets someone into office is hugely important. And you're right, I am very passionate about politics. And then in off years, having an understanding of government, which is very different, you know, it's harder in a way because people who work in government don't really have to talk to reporters. They often don't want to talk to reporters. Information is in some ways easier to come by because of the FOIA law, but in some ways it's harder, you know, like candidates, everything is happening at a rapid clip during an election. So you may or may not get information you need, but you're kind of moving along quickly. And in government, you're waiting. Everything is slower. Things involve many more people. There's bureaucracies and layers to things. There's lawyers and policy people who weigh in on things we're writing about. And so it takes a different set of information. It can be hard to translate government stories to readers. They can be wonkier and a little more complicated, but extremely important. I try to devote my time to both, to like really understanding municipal governance and the areas that we cover at Politico, which isn't everything. We have specialty areas, budget, labor, contracts, affordable housing, real estate in general. But to your first question, you're right. Politics is something I am really, really interested in. And I try to challenge myself every election cycle to cover it in a new way and not get stale and kind of constantly understand voting trends and demographics and what makes people in the ecosystem tick.
I love the politics. There was a point at which, you know, you referenced my first, last, and probably only run for office in 1997 when I ran for city council. I think of what we do, I think of good political journalism as really an adjunct of governance, not necessarily of the government, because we're sort of the opposition to a certain extent or an accountability function, but we're part of it. When I take my students down to City Hall to show them the city council chambers, I point out that there's a gallery there for the press, that even if not one more person can fit into the room, there's going to be some media there to try and carry things forward. And the same at the Supreme Court. Long, long line of people stretched around the block waiting to come in to hear oral arguments. There's always a section there for the press. And it means something. It means something. It means that you've got to be responsible, that you're there to help inform people about things that are really, really important. And so that part of it, the government reporting, I love. And New York being a big, complicated city, you talk about what you get from having a legal background or legal training. I tell people, give me original documents and don't be afraid to dump all of it on me. Like, one thing they do teach you in law school is how to chew through a lot of material very quickly and efficiently and to not be afraid of it. Technical information included. Let's have it. I'll figure it out. If I really can't use it, that's on me, but I want to have it in front of me. And the political side of it, one part of this, and I'd be curious if Sally is seeing this too, something magical almost happens about halfway to three quarters of the way through a contest of the kind we're watching now for mayor, which is that people who started out with almost no answers to most important questions, people who up until that point maybe weren't even taken all that seriously as political figures, not big thinkers, not setting the world on fire, they mature and they grow and they get a lot better very, very quickly. I mean, it's just amazing. I remember back covering the Dinkins run in 1989, where up until that point, David Dinkins was like, he was part of this so-called, you know, Gang of Four. He was almost universally acknowledged to not be the brightest of that group. That was Percy Sutton. He wasn't the most flamboyant of that group. That was Charlie Rangel. He wasn't even the sort of the nicest guy or known as the nicest guy. That was Basil Paterson. But David Dinkins was like the workhorse. He was kind of a foul-mouthed district leader. He'd cuss up a storm. He'd find him smoking cigarettes and stuff. And throughout that remarkable campaign, he becomes David Dinkins. He becomes this ambassador of peace, and so much of what we later came to know and value and in some cases love about him really just sort of emerged. I love moderating these forums and stuff because you start out at the beginning of the season and they don't have a lot of answers. And it's clear that they really had never even pondered some of the questions. A typical politician has maybe like two or three big things they want to accomplish, and the rest is just a mystery, or they'll figure it out along the way. Well, along the way means when you're doing your 10th forum or your 15th forum or your 20th forum, and people are introducing you to really almost obscure but really important points of urban governance or municipal operations, and they start developing a philosophy. They start maturing right before your very eyes. And by the end of it, whoever we elect as mayor is pretty much ready to do the job. I love that part of helping them get there, because I think, especially as we get older, we become part of that. We can help fill in some of the history that they may not have as candidates. We can tell them, like, look, this is not the first time somebody's talked about closing Rikers Island. This guy named Herb Sturz was talking about it in the 1970s and it almost happened. So let's not start from scratch if we can avoid it. That part of all of this, I think, is often underrated, but really important. And as cynical as some people get about politics, I never get cynical about the possibility of candidates getting much, much better, because I've seen that they can do it. They can, in fact, rise to the occasion.
It seems to me that for anybody that loves politics, journalist or not, covering the City Hall beat or being involved with City Hall has got to be a high. At least that's how I view it, sitting here in City Hall as we speak. Errol, you became host of Inside City Hall in 2010. What was your vision for that show and how has it evolved through the years?
I've been there for 10 years now, so it is time to, I guess, look back and think, what was I thinking? I stepped into a show that had a history. It had some really strong personalities who had done a great job with the show and had really invented the format. So I wish I could take more credit for the basic format, but I can't. To a certain extent, I inherited a lot of it. What I did try and do, or have tried to do, is put my own stamp on it. And, you know, I try and make sure we pay attention to court cases, that we pay attention to the third branch. I'm very proud that we've done some forums. You can't have debates for candidates for judge. They're not allowed to formally debate, but I've had them on and I've explained what the surrogates court is and why it matters and why you're going to see a name on the ballot that you should probably be aware of. And here's the candidate and here's what they're going to do, that kind of a thing. One of the bigger things I have tried to do is something I learned from Lou Dobbs, who I did some work with at CNN. I was one of his guests. And along the way, you figure out how to do makeup and how to sit and how to speak succinctly and do all the other TV things that people value. But one thing that he did that I have tried to bring to Inside City Hall Hall is he made that show into kind of almost a soap opera, an ongoing series, a drama that would just go from episode to episode with some recurring themes, with some heroes and some villains and other characters. Really was, you know, kind of the opposite of what a lot of journalists are trained to do. Typical journalist is trained, you get the story, you do the story, you turn the story, and then you move on. And when asked about it, you say, well, we already did that. And you don't come back to it. One thing that I realized you can do when you have a show is, well, look, I've got 200 shows a year, so let's come back to this topic. And I've identified it. I mean, I sometimes just say it on the air. I say, look, we're going to come back to this. You're going to see more about this. We'll come back to it in a few weeks. We'll come back to it when the next stage of this story evolves. And informally, and I guess just based on the metrics that are available to me, it seems to work. It's something I always wanted to see, frankly, in the news, that it's not just a bunch of disconnected stories that pop up and have no particular relevance to each other, but it's part of an evolving story of the city. And helping people make sense, of course, is what the whole point is.
We'll be right back with more from our conversation with Errol Lewis and Sally Goldenberg. But I want to take a second to encourage our listeners to get vaccinated today by visiting vax4nyc.nyc.gov. You can also call 877-VAX4NYC. It's never been easier to get a COVID-19 vaccination in New York City. All New Yorkers age 12 and older are eligible for the vaccine. Those who are fully vaccinated can more safely gather with friends and enjoy other benefits of vaccination. Many vaccination sites in the city no longer require appointments. To find a vaccination site near you, including those that take appointments, use the city's vaccine finder at vax4nyc.nyc.gov. And remember, even after you are vaccinated, you should continue to wear a face covering and practice physical distancing when in a public indoor space, outdoors in crowded areas, or when attending gatherings with unvaccinated people. Thanks for listening, and back to you, Capel.
It's really interesting. Both of you have referenced the different mediums, TV, print, radio, digital. Do either of you have a favorite medium to consume the news of the day?
I'm definitely a print person, but I do sort of a mix. I'm not just saying this because Errol's on. I'm a huge New York One consumer. We have it on in room 9 in the City Hall, you know, press room. It's a very good station that does really serious journalism. And so I find myself consuming print in the morning and TV in the evening. I actually like radio a lot. I think because I don't drive, I don't have a natural reason to listen to the radio. I found that when I lived in New Jersey a long time ago and drove, I consumed a lot of news over the radio, which is sort of a more natural fit. But I like print. I sort of like being able to take the time to kind of read something at my pace. And because of social media, which Twitter is a big part of what I do. And so when I'm reading a story, it's easier to pull out a piece and tweet it if it's on TV. Although this is mayoral campaign season, and now the candidates go on TV a fair amount and go on radio a fair amount. So that's sort of expanding my horizons a bit.
I start with print every morning like everybody else does. Twitter, I have found to be very, very helpful as a quick summary. If there is no time to really get caught up on stuff, I will just check the Twitter feed and you can usually get some sense of some of the issues that are going on. And lately, it's become so ideological. A lot of the stuff is just wrong. And so depending on the story, it can end up being more of a waste of time trying to sort of fact check what some random person has kind of thrown out there for ideological reasons. And I thank you, Sally, for talking about New York One from its very first days, and this predates you younger people. The whole thing about it was the whole political class would have it on and have the sound down. And then when something interesting would come on, you would turn up the sound. And my goal all along has been, I wanted to be one of those people that you would turn up the sound for. Like, if you see my face on the screen, please turn up the sound, because I hope I'm going to give you something that's interesting and informative and kind of move your knowledge of the city forward in a meaningful way. And radio doesn't figure as much. I was always a big Howard Stern fan. And when I'm in the car, assuming my kid is not there and it's not too obscene, I'll put on Howard Stern just because I like good radio. You know, it's just good. It's well-crafted. It's thoughtful. The topic itself might be utterly ludicrous or inconsequential, but there is an art to it. I used to listen to Michael Savage for the same reason, the Savage Nation, when I was working out. You know, not because I believed anything that he said. It wasn't meant to be believed. It's meant to be enjoyed.
Both of you engage with people on social media on a regular basis. My question is how social media has affected the race to break stories. What is your strategy when you are thinking about whether to put something out that perhaps pre-social media, you would have spent more time confirming before reporting it?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think about this a lot, obviously, because this is an ever-changing dynamic. Social media, and Twitter in particular, is the main avenue that I use. I think Politico uses Instagram and Facebook, but I just kind of primarily have taken to use Twitter for professional purposes. I try not to break news that I think my readers would want to read on Twitter before we publish it. I try to tweet news that has been published, you know, in Politico and elsewhere, because really the obligation is, you know, to the readers and to people who are reading Politico. So I kind of see Twitter as more of a platform to highlight things in the news, in my stories, in my staff's stories, and in colleagues at other publications' stories that I think should be out there. And then it, you know, invariably devolves as the day goes on into people question motives and accuracy constantly. And I don't know how the press corps who covered the White House prior to Joe Biden dealt with that. It's hard. I find it very hard. Like, my motives and my objectivity and my accuracy is questioned all day long in ways that I never even thought. It's so out of left field that sometimes I'm almost surprised that someone would even think whatever the crazy things people think are. And it's hard to figure out exactly how to deal with it. You know, I'm kind of constantly trying to think about the right way to defend the publication, defend the industry that I love and I'm proud to be a part of, defend my work, not get personal. You know, it's a whole thing in and of itself.
I try to only use social media to promote and project the platforms that I work on, right? So I want people to read my column. I want people to listen to my podcast. I definitely want people to watch the show. And if there's a big breaking news story that we're clearly going to cover, even if I don't have any particular facts or anything, frankly, interesting to add, I'll say, hey, this just happened. We'll have more on this on Inside City Hall tonight. I try to limit it to that. But just as Sally says, you inevitably start getting into other stuff.
I want to turn quickly to the pandemic. Can you both talk a little bit about how COVID has impacted your work as reporters, first and foremost? And secondly, what it's like covering the mayoral campaign during this extremely unique time?
For us, just as a workplace, I was shocked at the speed with which we set up an entire infrastructure where I broadcast out of my living room television every night for like 6 months. And I think about on a typical broadcast when we're all in the studio, something always goes wrong. And so I was thinking, this is going to be a complete meltdown. This is going to be Armageddon. It's going to be a complete disaster. And they rose to the occasion in ways I never even imagined possible, to the point where by the end of the summer, when they were asking if I would come back in, I was like, well, I'm actually okay right here. I like having a 30-second commute home. I like just being able to turn off the lights and then that's it. We're back to a skeleton crew where most people are still not in the studio, where normally there'd be dozens, if not hundreds of people in the studio at any given time. There's now, I don't know, no more than 15 at a time because of COVID restrictions. No more in-studio guests. Everything is live. It takes away some of the control that we used to have over the kind of stories we could do and when we could do them. But I think we and the audience are all getting used to it. Ours is going to be one of those newsrooms that will not be the same when all of this is over, because we know for sure that we can put out a quality product in ways that don't require 100 people being in the room at the same time. So what all that means for the future remains to be seen, but it is definitely going to be different when we all get back to the new normal.
It's, I think, easier with print because we can do a lot of this from home. It's not ideal, but it's not the same as TV and radio to a lesser extent where, you know, being in person, getting the shot, there's not as much to navigate. The thing that has been sort of hard is covering a campaign remotely, somewhat remotely. I was actually out yesterday in person with a mask, trying to keep a safe distance. But for the most part, this campaign has been done virtually. And that's really hard. You know, it's hard not to see how voters react to people. You don't get a feel for a campaign over Zoom. And also the primary is in June as opposed to September. So all of the summer events that we normally cover that are really active, where parades and block parties the candidates go to, where you really see like how a voter reacts to a candidate and how they react to a voter, that's lost irrespective of COVID because of the changed calendar, which I think is kind of unfortunate. fortunate for that reason. But yeah, I find covering a political campaign during COVID enormously hard, much more so than de Blasio's Blue Room press conference that we Zoom into is fine. It's nice to be in person to ask him the question so you can do a follow-up. But I am finding being on the campaign trail from behind my computer, a lot is missing. So I hope that we have an opportunity to do some in-person reporting.
It reminds me, Sally, of Barack Obama in 2004 at the Democratic National Convention. So this is up in Boston. And these are the last few hours before then state senator Barack Obama became a national and international figure. So I'm watching him in the final hours of his relative anonymity. But you could see it even then, that the charisma would just was just flowing off him. It was unbelievable. And I remember a woman brings her kid over, takes a picture of him with her kid, takes a picture of him. Him and then turned to me and said, "Who is that?" And then that night he gives the keynote speech at the convention. And I realized he could sort of throw that same energy electronically. And I was like, oh boy, this is going to be something. All that is gone now in the race for mayor.
Yeah.
Like you can't see how people connect because the candidates themselves are flying blind a little.
Yeah.
You know, they don't know what gets a rise out of people on a Zoom call. Maybe a little less demagoguery. There might be some upside to that, I guess.
Unfortunately, we have run out of time. I could talk to Sally and Errol for hours, but I know everyone has to get back to work. I'll just close by saying I think one of the keys to great journalism is trust. And there are no journalists that I trust more than Errol and Sally. New York City is lucky to have both of you here, and we're very lucky to have both of you covering City Hall. And I'm truly grateful for both of you taking time to share your wisdom. And again, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedules to come on City Hall Pass.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
I want to thank our guests today, Errol Lewis and Sally Goldenberg. Both Errol and Sally play a critical role in our democracy, and their tireless efforts to keep the public informed about their city government is truly admirable. I hope you enjoyed this conversation and look forward to talking to you soon on another great episode of City Hall Pass.
This podcast is brought to you by the Office of the Counsel to the Mayor of New York City.